Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Any officer who goes into action without his sword is improperly dressed. Thanks so much for tuning in, Ridiculous Historians. Welcome to the show. My name is Ben, and that was a quote.
I'm sorry, I don't know why I like that. Makes me laugh. I was hoping it was just coming directly from you, and that was you just chastising people who are not properly accessorized with their sword.
Oddly enough, yeah, Noel, you and I have forgotten our swords today, but our super producer, Casey Pegram, is probably still strapped.
He's got two of them, like across his back, like a Ninja Turtle.
At all times.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, Ben, we're going to need a little context about that quote there.
That's true. That is not a quotation from me. It's not one from Casey. It's not one from you. It's just a quote that we all three happen to agree with. The source of this quote is a man named Lieutenant Colonel John Mad Jack Churchill. And he was not referring to a sword in a metaphorical sense, was he?
No, he wasn't. He was referring to, you know, a ceremonial military sword, you know, that's part of the whole getup. It really is more ceremonial than anything. I don't know that there was too much sword play going on the battlefield. But this is a man who was very, very concerned with tradition.
Yeah. And his sword was a little bit less ceremonial than most, right? He was Scottish, and he had a Scottish broadsword that he took with him to battle in World War II. This is a guy who is somehow not a character in a Quentin Tarantino film yet. And today, on this episode, we're going to learn a little bit about Lieutenant Colonel Churchill, and we're going to learn a little bit about why people called him Mad Jack. And spoiler, this is not an ironic nickname like Little John or something.
No, I mean, this really does have little hints of like the Inglourious Bastards in it for sure. You mentioned the Tarantino connection. It's because this was a man whose job it was to hunt down and kill Nazis. And he did it in a pretty creative way, as some of the bastards did in that Tarantino picture.
Mm-hmm. Let's dive into Churchill's life. We know he was born in 1906. His father was in the colonial service. He had engineering post and he worked in admin. And this meant that the family moved around. They had been in Sri Lanka, or present-day Sri Lanka. They had been in Hong Kong. And when Jack was born, the family was located in England. But there's still a little bit of disagreement there. Some historians will say he was in the colony in Sri Lanka, and some will say he was in Hong Kong. Anyhow, his father's family came from Oxfordshire, and his name reflects their inherited geography, their ancestry, because they're on the Anglo-Scottish border in the Highlands. So he actually had his full birth name is much longer than just John Churchill.
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Boland. A long name indeed. He was christened John Malcolm Thorpe Fleming Churchill.
See, I miss those days. You know, how many people get five names from the jump? Right?
I mean, it's certainly on the table, you know? Just not really done, but I think we should bring that back. It has an air of gravitas to it.
Yeah.
It's sort of setting up your child for success as some sort of dictator or, at the very least, a minor political player.
It also it gives you a moment to pause. You know, when your name is officially announced, now it's this parade of ideas. Most people in the States have, what I would say, on average, three names, first, middle, and last.
All I'm saying is it's good to have options.
Oh, yeah. That, you know, think about that, too. Like, we've all had friends, I imagine, who later in life choose one of their names to be their go-to name. Like,
right.
You might have a guy whose name is Fergus Jeremy Vanderschmidt. And growing up, he doesn't want to be called Fergus, so he's Jeremy in school. But then he gets into, like, his college age, and he's, like, into beat poetry right. and stuff. And he's like, now I'm Fergus.
Or Fergie, perhaps, and joins the Black Eyed Peas. Yeah. But see, here's the thing, though. Where does Jack come in? We've got John, Malcolm, Thorpe, Fleming, Churchill, and then he ends up with Jack.
Yeah.
What's Jack short for?
Jack must be short for John.
That makes no sense. Same number of syllables. I don't understand.
It's like Dick and Richard. Where did that come from?
No idea.
You know, because Rich was right there. Rich is in the front. Somebody went out of their way to call their child a dick.
I would agree with that. You know, the child probably had a bad attitude. You know, but here's the thing. Jack's father had a very pithy, little simple to the point name. It was Alec. And when Jack was four, Alec became the director of public works in Hong Kong. He moved his family to Asia, and they lived there for several years until 1917. And that is when young Jack became fascinated by exploration. He was kind of given free rein to just roam the city at will. And when he finally went back to England, he wanted to keep that going. You know, he had this thirst for exploration that he could not easily quench.
Yeah. And we don't know too much about the life and adventures of young Mad Jack Churchill, but we know a few things. He graduated from the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst in 1926. And after that, when he was only 20 years old, he was shipped off to Burma with the Manchester Regiment, and he also took some time to do some road trips. He drove his motorcycle around the region. And while he was there, we know that he learned to play the bagpipes, perhaps got a little bit obsessed with them.
I mean, there's really no way to just be casually interested in the bagpipes, Ben. That's at least how I feel about it. You know, once you get in with the bagpipes, you really got to become a total pipehead. Baghead?
Maybe baghead, just because piper doesn't work and pipehead has some sort of drug connotation.
I think you're probably right. What's the name of the thing that you blow into? I don't know. That's the hat.
These sound legit. I know you don't blow into the bag. The bag just takes some of the air. I do also know that bagpipes can sound good, but only in the hands of a professional.
That's my point. It's sort of like playing the harp or something. You can't be a casual harpist.
Or the oboe is really difficult.
It's also, you got to have your embouchure, which is the way you hold your mouth to make the blows.
Yeah. I mean, even the violin can sound ugly in the hands of a novice.
Trust me, dude. I mean, as a young violinist myself, I have been around many. We did group lessons for violin, and like that's with all the little kids up to the older kids. The little kids. Whew, that was hard.
Is it like T-ball versus Little League? Do the little kids have special violins?
You know, it's funny. The very little kids, before they even get a violin, they get a little box with a ruler taped to it and, like, a stick. And they just learn how to, like, bow and, like, you know, do the positions and all that stuff.
Do you still have yours?
I don't have my stick box, no.
Ah.
I do have my violin in a closet. It's covered in duct tape because I was in, like, sort of a punky, piratey band for a while, and I had a pickup that I just kind of taped onto it in a very DIY Tom Morello-y kind of way. But anyway, the bagpipes, it really called to young Jack. And during his motorcycle exploration days, he also got into archery. And in the 30s, he spent some time in Kenya, in Nairobi, in Kenya. He was a newspaper editor. He was a male model. He used his archery skills to get spots in films, like The Thief of Baghdad, which is quite famous, and A Yank at Oxford, where he served as an extra.
Right, and there's a little bit of context we have to paint here, because Churchill ended up in Kenya in 1936 because he left the army, and he left the army because he was bored, historians speculate, at the lack of conflict. It was too peaceful in the army for him. He was living a lot of these stories that people would dream about living, or he was actually doing things that people would write about and fantasize about.
In
in the lack of military conflict, he became obsessed with his two great loves. He, instead of spending his time killing people for the British Empire, he spent his time practicing the bagpipes and getting better and better at archery. In fact, he became an award-winning bagpipist and an award-winning archer.
That's right. In 1938, there was a military bagpipe competition. Because let's not forget, we've kind of buried this a little bit. The bagpipes were to the Scottish sort of the way like marching drums and bugles
fife.
And the fife or whatever. It's like what you would lead the charge with, you know, because you can hear it for miles and it's a very specific sound. And like you said, Ben, it really is, when done correctly, like our boy Jonathan Davis from the band Korn so skillfully does, it can be a very interesting sound. Actually, one of my favorite 80s musical breaks is in the song Under the Milky Way by The Church.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's
it's
great.
It's got a bagpipe solo and I think it's really cool.
They pull it off. They pull
do.
It off.
They
and
do.
I think you're being very generous and diplomatic by saying it is an interesting sound. Because some people might get mad at me here, folks, but I will advance to you that a good at least one out of five times you hear bagpipes in the wild, they're not going to sound great.
No, you're probably right, Ben. I do love the name of the place where this this military piping competition took place in 1938. It was called Aldershot Tattoo, and it actually set off a bit of a scandal because he was, in fact, an Englishman, and he was better at the bagpipes than many of the Scotsmen that were in the competition. It was a real upset.
Yeah, he was. He was a surprise second place winner, a bit of a dark horse candidate. And then the next year, 1939, he entered an archery competition, the World Archery Championship in Oslo, Norway, and he also got second place there. Keep in mind, he's still a young guy when this is all happening. He's in his 20s. He seems set to live this life of a roaming adventurer. Until 1939, the dawn of World War II.
Indeed, the infamous invasion of Poland by German forces, at which point he was forced to go back to his post in the British Army and become a part of the war effort, where he joined the British Expeditionary Force to France. And he... I don't know how this worked, like, because you would think, you know, the military is super regimented and they kind of, you know, there's everything's issued and everything from the uniform to the weapons. But they let him use his archery skills on patrol, which I think is really fascinating. He must have really showed them what he could do and convinced them that, hey, this is my weapon of choice and it can be a very deadly one.
Yeah, and that's correct. And you're not mishearing us. He was literally using a bow in war. As odd as that might sound, the bow actually held up pretty well against the contemporaneous firearms of the time.
Let's remember, a bow and arrow is absolutely silent. And there's an article on history-uk.com that cites the stat that it is highly accurate as well, up to 200 yards. So it's essentially like, you know, a silent sniper rifle.
And Vice.com has this great article about Mad Jack that describes some of his guerrilla tactics. So right after the Allied retreat to Dunkirk in mid-1940, Mad Jack starts practicing his shoot and move, stick and move guerrilla tactics. He stages raids. He gets awards for his bravery. He gets clipped by machine gun fire and survives. And this is, okay, I mean, Casey, maybe you can help us out with some Tarantino-esque sound cues that'll pop up here whenever we say there's a Tarantino moment. Here's a Tarantino moment. One time, Mad Jack is watching German forces move from a tower in a tiny village, Le Penier. And Mad Jack, when he sees the group moving, he takes his longbow and he pulls it back and then, boom, he shoots a Nazi sergeant straight through the chest with a barbed arrow. And then after that arrow, right after that arrow, his infantrymen who are hanging with him just mow the place down with bullets.
Just light them up. And I guess a barbed arrow would make it impossible to pull it out without just absolutely doing irreparable damage to your gut parts.
Yeah.
Not a nice way to go. I mean, think about how painful that would be. He then was able to rejoin his company and led them across enemy lines under cover of night, even though he was nursing that shoulder shot.
Yeah. And this is the thing. Earlier I said he had been clipped with machine gun fire, but there's something you have to understand. And anybody who is unfortunate enough to have been shot and survived, who's listening in the audience today, you know exactly what I mean when I say that the movies are lying to you. Everyone, every single person alive is genuinely startled by even a flesh wound from a quote unquote flesh wound from a machine gun or a firearm. It hurts. It's dangerous. And the weird thing is sometimes, and I think this explains Mad Jack, sometimes when people are shot, the adrenaline that they're experiencing that's flooding their body keeps them from noticing the pain until much later. So he might have not even noticed he had been shot until much later. But this famous longbow incident makes him the only British soldier to have felled an enemy with a longbow during World War II. That, for most people, that's enough. Now you're in the history books, right? Now you can retire. Go back to being a male model. Play bagpipes in Orientalist films.
Yeah, atop your motorcycle, you know? I mean, really, really interesting guy, for sure. So advancing a little bit in the timeline to 1941, when Churchill actually put himself forth as a volunteer for this new elite squad of British commandos. He actually helped launch a raid, a very successful raid, on a Nazi garrison and some of their supply stores. And they had fish oil factories as well at Vagsøy, I imagine. This is one of these little... what do you call it? Little accents that I'm unfamiliar with in the Norwegian language.
The tiny O.
And then also the O with an X through it, which I so love. Cool. So I don't quite know how those add to the pronunciation. So we always try to do our best. This was an island, right? So this Nazi garrison was on the island of Vagsøy in Norway. And so his commando group, British number 3 battalion, landed on December 27th in 1941, and it was to the sound of those iconic bagpipes.
Yes,
it's the drone that really sets them apart. Let's just break down really quick the components of a bagpipe. You got the bag that you have to keep pumping, because as you're pumping it, that's what's circulating air to create that drone. And then you are blowing into it in between playing on the fluty part, which I think is called the
blow stick.
Is it really called the blow stick?
It's literally called the blow stick.
What's the other part? I swear to God, there's a part.
There's the chanter reed.
That's
the chanter reed.
That's what I was fumbling
at. The blow stick. Mm-hmm.
So that's the part that there's the fluty bit that makes sort of the melody, while the drone is created by inflating and deflating the giant bag. Mm-hmm. So you have that combination of almost just that drone of doom, you know, on the low end that just keeps going. It's just endless. And then you have that kind of creepy melody up top.
Correction, the blow stick is its own thing. The chanter is separate.
Right. The chanter, I believe, is the fluty part.
The chanter is the fluty part that produces the melody notes, and there's also the tuning slide, not to be confused.
The blow stick, I believe, is what you have to continuously, you know, switch over to and inflate to get the bag to, you know, be full.
So he's doing this in the middle of a war.
He's doing this in the middle of a war.
It's the important part.
It is a very important part. Bagpipe mechanics aside.
Yeah. So,
you know, the Nazis heard that. And as far as they're concerned, that's the sound of their own demise, the sound of doom.
Right. Casey, if we can, let's play a clip, if we can, of the song that Mad Jack played. It's called The March of the Cameron Men.
Thank you.
So Casey, off mic, you said something interesting about that while we were playing it. What's your take?
Well, I just said it sounds like every other bagpipe composition I've ever heard in my life.
And I said, because of that drone, right?
Yeah.
Because the elements are just really, there's really no way around it.
It's hard to escape it. And I feel like I should just be watching like a parade in a movie where something's going on. People are glaring at each other, maybe.
Yep, that's right.
And then Mel Gibson is in the background going, freedom!
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So something like that does kind of happen. This is another Tarantino moment if we ever manage to get that sound cue. As he hits the shore, he stops playing the bagpipes. He throws them somewhere, probably tucks them behind his back. I don't know. And he jumps out of the boat. He lobs a grenade at the German forces. He draws his freaking broadsword, screams, and then runs into the battle.
Yeah, ironically, this was known as Operation Archery. he didn't seem to employ his ninja silent bow skills in this one. He wanted to go straight into the fray. And I mean, it really was kind of almost like a kamikaze mission. You know, he was just blasting his way into the, you know, the fray without any sense of self-preservation at all. It's really, in the screaming, you know, I mean, good Lord, yeah. The image here is very, very visceral.
And we're not exaggerating, because it turns out there's actually some film footage that you can find of the raid and then of Jack himself playing his bagpipes on deck after the whole shebang. As a matter of fact, let's just play. I know we're clip heavy this episode, but you guys want to hear this?
I'm loving it.
Yeah.
As all look back to shore, the telltale fires blaze a victory message that never can be told or written. Victory with a capital V, and one that will be recorded indelibly in all history. The intrepid bagpiper who led the commandos in battle now leads them in a dance of joy. It's a well-earned diversion they seek. A deck of cards and a friendly game, or restful sleep, or a trip to the barber.
Okay, so here's what's going on. This is an old propaganda video. It's definitely worth your time to watch. Some of you Perfect Strangers fans in the audience may have caught the phrase dance of joy.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the soldiers there. I would say for the era, what they're doing is, you know, you could call that getting down. They're getting down.
Yeah, what they're actually doing is dancing a Highland fling, which is a very popular dance in Scottish culture.
You know, you lock elbows, mm-hmm. you go around in a circle.
Yep. A lot of fancy footwork.
Mm-hmm.
Famously portrayed in the Highlander films.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm kidding, not really. But you should,
in the franchise, I think it's a subtext.
It may well be.
Yeah. There can only be one Highland fling. We also know that this crazy semi-suicidal action earned Churchill the Military Cross. He did have another close call and another semi-serious injury during this time, but it was at the party after the battle.
It's funny. There's a in the Vice article that we've been citing. They put the word demolition expert in quotes because apparently during this party when Jack was drinking a bottle of wine, this demolition quotation fingers expert accidentally set off a charge. I wonder if he was drunkenly showing off or something.
There's a hold my beer moment.
Bragging about his expertise. And yeah, that bottle of wine got exploded, and shards of it were lodged in his forehead. But I mean, as we know, it's going to take a lot more than a few wine shards in the skull to get old Jack down. So he was back to piping and slicing and, you know, archering very quickly. By 1943, he was in Italy for another campaign.
Arching? Archering? They both sound fun.
Yeah. I don't know.
Bowman?
I don't know. He could be. I don't know. I think it would be archering.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
An archerist.
Right. I don't know. Man, we got to have to look this up, but no. Right. Let's move forward.
Just make up a fun phrase describing that and give us your pitch. So, yes, you're correct. In 1943, he is back on the road seeking blood and treasure in the Great War. He has a reputation for being crazy at this point. There's no other way to say it. He is incredibly bellicose and aggressive. He is known for going on unofficial raids and counterattacks. I think something just got his dander up or his blood up, and he would literally go through his crew or the people who are around him. He would say things like, you know, you and you come with me. So we would pick a few soldiers that he thought had grit and a willingness to die. And these practices continue even when he becomes a commanding officer leading commandos. And this is where we get the iconic image of Mad Jack. He's got his broadsword around his waist. He's got his longbow and he's got arrows. He's carrying the bagpipes still. And people who serve with him start to see him as an icon. You know, he is like a superhero to them.
Word gets around when you charge screaming into battle, brandishing a broadsword, when that is very much an anachronistic weapon in those times. And like, he's the crazy nut that shoots Nazis with arrows, you know? I mean, like, really, his reputation absolutely preceded him.
So let's pause there. Let's make this, as a matter of fact, part one of the story of Mad Jack. I like the idea of holding him for a moment beyond time. Mm-hmm. Just this image of a real life superhero, a source of inspiration, something that rallied people. Just seeing this guy on the battlefield probably kept some people going, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, he didn't, it wasn't the kind of madness that, you know, caused people to not want to be around him. It was the kind of madness that would rally other people around his absolute courage and bravado. And just, he was a real character, as we are going to hear much more about in part two.
Well, Germans didn't want to be around him.
No, Germans didn't want to be around him, but he wanted to be around them, and he wanted right. to give them a good slice, which they clearly had coming.
So what exactly happened to Mad Jack? What did he tell his followers to scream on the battlefield? And what are the other Tarantino moments of his strange, bloody career?
Oh, there's going to be quite a few, my friends.
And you'll find out when you tune in for our next episode.
In the meantime, huge thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, research associate Gabe Luger for hipping us to this incredible story of blood, treasure, and bravado.
A big, big thanks, of course, to Christopher Hasiotis, to Eves Jeffcoat. Huge thanks, as always, to Young Quizzles, a.k.a. the Quizzerino, a.k.a. the Quizmeister, also known in some circles as Jonathan Strickland.
I hear he's buying a franchise of Quiznos sub shops.
Finally, good. You know what I like about them is they heat the sandwich as, like, the de facto starting point.
It's toasted. There's no option. You can't get an untoasted sandwich at Quiznos. They'd ask you to leave.
Yeah, well, you know, they should.
They really should. It's barbaric.
Well, Jonathan, if you're listening, don't screw that up for me.
Seriously. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.